UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on bethinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
Wednesday, the Wednesday after, and the Wednesday after that. So, you'll see me a couple of times. I'd like you to stop me if you don't understand what I'm talking about. Or if you can't follow. And, feel free to pick up your hand and say it's too difficult. Friedrich Nietzsche is a major contributor to the current philosophical debate. Many postmodern philosophers such as Foucault, Derrida, and Lyotard refer to Nietzsche in their works. He still has a profound influence on our culture's thinking and is therefore not a thinker to be skipped over lightly. His work has had a large influence on the central themes of the 20th century philosophy as well as arts and literature. In these lectures, I hope that we'll gain some insights with regard to Nietzsche's thinking as well as our culture's thinking. And I hope that this study will also have implications for our personal lives. If you can identify yourself with some of the topics that Nietzsche is discussing in his works, I hope that this study will help you also further your own opinion with regard to these topics. Some cryptic biographical details before I carry on about Nietzsche might help in understanding why he chooses the topics he does to talk about in his works. Friedrich Nietzsche was born in 1844 in Leipzig to a Lutheran clergyman and his wife, obviously. Both his mother and father were children of fathers who were clergymen. And so you can see that the interest of theology in his family was already quite long existing. Nietzsche's father passed away when he was 5 years old. So he was brought up by his mother and his elder sister and his unmarried aunts and his grandmother. Nietzsche started out by studying theology, but soon left his study and his faith in that behind for the study of philology, which is the science of language. Already at the age of 24, he became a professor of the chair of classical philology in the University of Basel. He stayed there until 1879 when his health started to deteriorate. And notwithstanding excruciating health circumstances with terrible stomach aches and headaches, just to mention a few of his ailments, he continued to write nevertheless. And between 1880 and 1889, he withdrew himself and lived off of the pension of the university. He lived in France and Switzerland and Italy. However, in 1889, he collapsed and went insane. And he remained in a condition of mental and physical paralysis until his death in 1900. Just to give you a bit of a quick background. Now that we have some background, let's move on to Nietzsche's views. However, before starting, I think that it's essential to realize that in order to enter into a real dialogue with someone, you need to find a point of agreement. You need to find common ground. I think that it's crucial to find something in what somebody is saying which you respect. In order for me to show where my critique lies with regard to Nietzsche's philosophy, I'll therefore first make a detour by explaining a phenomenon which I find in our society today, which will then bring me to some common ground with Nietzsche. And so by way of introduction then, I hope I don't flummox you too much, but I'd like to ask you what the word professional in our society brings to mind. Well-trained, yes. experience, yeah? Somebody highly qualified for applying a degree in a specific direction. And what are the thoughts then which are brought to mind when you hear the word professionalism? A way of portraying what? I would, because it's an ism, I would think that it's a, what comes to my mind is having a more extreme form of being professional. Perhaps placing the idea of being professional as of utmost importance also within your relationships. That's the juxtaposition that I would put there. In this lecture, I'd like to begin by taking a look at our society today, which is characterized, among others, by the manifestation of professionalism. In our enterprises, a good case in point can be seen in the healthcare sector. I'd then like to proceed by going back in time and looking at the modern philosopher Nietzsche's analysis of the 19th century society already around him, and see in his analysis already then a link between our professionalism scenario today. I'll then take a look at some of Nietzsche's answers to the problems he encountered. And in looking at these answers, I hope to raise some questions about what will bring meaning in life. So to look at the first part of the lecture. Initially, before I start, I need to make it clear that in my discussion here, I'm talking about absolutizing the phenomenon of being professional, as is obvious in the word professionalism, and not about the legitimate desire to increase our proficiency and skills. To get an idea about what is accepted as professional behavior, according to our society, let's take a look at some definitions. Carl Sanders defined professionalism in the professions as specialized skill and training, minimum fees of salaries, formation of professional associations, and codes of ethics governing professional practice. Professional associations are distinguished by the degree to which they seek to establish minimum qualifications for entrance into professional practice or activities, to enforce appropriate rules and norms of conduct among members of the professional group, and to raise the status of the professional group in a larger society. And Follin and Mills in professionalization define it as that process in which, through specialization, institutionalization, and a variety of other means, the playing field of the professional is increased and that of the layman is diminished. As such, there's nothing wrong with these descriptions of the need for the specialization of tasks, of narrowing down the things, the variety of things people must feel responsible for by defining them well, and of avoiding any overlap within responsibilities. The problem, however, arises in what it means to be human. Our society increasingly identifies us by the work we do and by our degree of productivity and consumption. And so the demand for professionalism floods us with questions such as, do we have the correct professional attitude towards our occupation? Are we keeping our professional distance? Have we sufficiently revised and localized our profession? With the seemingly essential questions about what it means to be human falling by the wayside, such as, are we treating our fellow human being responsibly and not only according to the norms and values prescribed by our society, which thinks that these norms and values would be professional? Are we doing justice to our fellow human being with regard to his or her talents and personal needs with our continuous campaign of reorganization in the workplace brought about actually by economic reasoning? And in our specialization of tasks, have we not subsequently minimized the diversity within jobs to the core and ignored the very human need for creative expression? To make it concrete, let's take a look at a more specific example of professionalism. Complaints about this phenomenon are especially rife within the healthcare sector, as far as I know, although it's a germ which can be encountered all over. Hitschermacher, a medical professor in the Netherlands, describes this phenomenon as follows. In recent decades, many of us have had the impression that the medical care sector constantly had to tighten its belts. Continuous economizing because of government withdrawal, combined with project enlargement and efficiency measures from within the institutions themselves, reinforced the image of deterioration. More and more work had to be done by fewer and fewer professionals. This image is incorrect. Available statistics for personnel in medical care in general, and in medical health care in particular, reveal that the number of professionals, on the contrary, has sharply increased. Why, then, are there still all these disturbing reports about scarcity in medical care? Because medical problems are increasing? Possibly. But the professionalization of society in general and of the healthcare sector in particular plays just as big a role. What types of things can be gleaned from Hitschermacher's account here? Addressed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it would seem that in practice, the general encounter with professionalism actually leads to experiencing constraint instead of improvement. And this constraint is especially rife because of the professional distance that people are trying to pose. And in an attempt to maintain this professional distance, the reasons behind choices are often not disclosed. And with the potential talents of the individuals involved not necessarily being considered, but with economics as the actual underlying factor behind decisions being made, people experience a loss of human dignity. And the anonymity with which orders are given to people for the restructuring in the workplace stifles the possibility for natural reaction and communication. The results are frequently experienced as meaningless restrictions. People often, however, refer to professionalism as if it's the redeeming factor of our society, that it should bring good behavior and good value for money. However, it would seem as if the reverse is actually true. It does not appear, humanly speaking, as if this desired phenomenon brings desired results. Apparently, we're doing something wrong. Hitschermacher continues by describing the negative impact of buying to professionalism on the employees. He says, for many professionals, the threats outweigh the challenges at the moment. This is expressed in many ways. One gets angry, another digs his heels in, a third gets burnout, while yet another withdraws himself into a surgery. Here we see that in the constant process of reassembling and refurbishing ourselves in order to stay on top of our profession, we lose our human dignity. the constant pressure to keep our knowledge and skills base up to date creates a very high level of tension. With our desire to be professional and our subsequent competition-oriented environment, we've somehow allowed a tense atmosphere to creep into the workplace through the back door. As Hitchmarker describes it, in recent years, the natural tension between the institution and the professional has been upset. The effects of a large overhead are very sharply felt by the professionals. More and more has to be done in less and less time. In addition, institutions have gotten many more administrative tasks, also with regard to the primary process. A well-organized work arrangement is desirable for business economic reasons. And because many professionals have little or no affinity for this, a new group of managers have appeared on the scene for this task, with the result that the prominent role of the professional becomes less visible and bureaucracy soars. Now, there may well be understandable explanations for why this problem has occurred. Nevertheless, for business economic reasons, amongst others, we seem to have gotten ourselves into a mess, with medical personnel spending more time in meetings giving explanations for why they're doing what they're doing, and pen pushing, writing down on paper to cover themselves for their actions, and feeling restrictive in time spent doing what they're actually qualified to do, to care for the patient, frustration reigns. Experiencing a scarcity of personnel in the workplace to do the job that really needs doing is subsequently rife. But this phenomenon has not only reached epidemic proportions in the medical world, but in other areas of life as well. And so for those of you who feel that you're still in school and that the germ of professionalism has not yet reached you, it's also infiltrated our schooling system. The quality of what we learn is often measured in efficiency, as the cartoon of Calvin and Hobbes will tell you. Calvin says, "I've come up with a new system for doing homework. I call it effective time management, or ETM for short. I've drawn up a schedule for each school subject, and I use this kitchen timer to monitor my pace. Thanks to ETM, I'm much more efficient, and my work goes faster. Ring! There, my math minute is up. Set the clock for my spelling assignment, okay?" says Calvin to Hobbes. And Hobbes replies, "Your schedule calls for smaller time increments than this clock can measure." So none of us are free from this bug living in the 21st century. Let's move on to the second part of the lecture. You may wonder why this discussion on professionalism, if I clearly meant to talk to you about Nietzsche. Why do I, from a 21st century perspective, experience moments of recognition in Nietzsche's critique on the market-driven society of the 19th century? What resemblances do I hear resounding in his descriptions? The correlation seems to be more specific than just plain a loss of human dignity. When Nietzsche describes the herd mentality of a society which emphasizes utility, expressed in a particular code of required behavior, I sense a certain parallel. Our society is obviously further down the road and in the midst of a different ball game. However, the etiquette professionalism that we stick on so many of our profit-driven occupations today, in which we demand that people keep their professional distance in order to be professional, reveals certain parallels with Nietzsche's generalizing herd mentality. If we look at the parallel, taking into consideration the tools that Nietzsche had at his disposal, and looking at the things that he sees, I think that the same analysis can be used today. Not claiming that professionalism and that the analysis that Nietzsche gives of his society with its herd morality are the same phenomenon. No, not that. But what I notice is a similar attitude towards humanity. They, professionalism and Nietzsche's analysis, presuppose a type of nonchalance, a lack of authenticity with regard to being human. As a citizen of late 19th century Europe, with its increasingly prosperous society, Nietzsche diagnoses a very relevant problem with Western culture. Towards the end of the Industrial Revolution, he comes to the insight that the mechanization of society promotes the dulling of the virtues of honesty and integrity. All around them, Nietzsche notices a mass conformism in which mediocrity and bureaucratic specialization govern a technocratic society, causing a loss of human dignity. And so throughout his works, Nietzsche expresses a desire for refuge from the harsh competition produced by capitalism. He reveals a hunger to be free from all the constraints caused by a consumption-driven society. And this realization results in his need to reassess the human condition. For in a society which increasingly identifies me by the work I do, how do I understand myself? Who do I understand myself to be in a Western culture that largely attempts to describe human beings in some form of reductionism? A culture that only sees me for the function I fulfill, and that is not at all concerned with who I am. It just leaves me to deal with this lack of humanness in my own private life. How do I survive as a person in a world which is characterized more and more by the image of a machine, a mechanized universe? In Nietzsche's analysis of the 19th century, we can see several things which he points out. The first point, A, Nietzsche points out that the constant emphasis on utility and technology influences how we view ourselves and how we view life. He warns us in his work Beyond Good and Evil that however gratefully one may welcome the objective spirit, one must learn caution even with regard to one's gratitude, and put a stop to the exaggeration with which the unselfing and depersonalizing of the spirit has recently been celebrated. He's only an instrument, we may say. He's a mirror. He's no purpose in himself. For the most part, a man without frame and content, a selfless man. So what type of characteristics does Nietzsche mention here of how we view human beings in a technological society? Yeah, the machine in the sense that he's an instrument. He's no purpose in himself. A means to an end. Yeah. Nietzsche is clearly suspicious of a technocratic society in which people are reduced to mere utilitarian instruments and as a result are ostracized from themselves. Individual personality is suppressed, therefore, and is exchanged for being a mere reflection. The second point, B, Nietzsche sees that in a technocratic society, utility is more important than being human. Technology reduces all of life to the productive order and to measurable benefits. And so we see, he says, they, which he refers to as the masses, accept good as identical with useful and pleasant without further thought. As regards every system of utilitarianism, one may at once assume that it has the same origin. What is the result, then, of this overemphasis on technology? Yeah, the moral virtue of good is subsequently perceived as a synonym for that which is serviceable, useful, and pleasant. Uh-huh. Yeah. I think it's a bit more than that, because it's also implying the moral aspect of it. Good. The calculation of profit and loss then becomes a determining factor in life. And for this reason, Nietzsche is skeptical of the criteria by which we measure success or failure. And I think rightly so. The third point, C. In his work, The Gay Science, Nietzsche sees sharply that the utility of an overly mechanized society with its required adaptation of the self to society, overasks people. And he says, living in a constant chase after gain compels people to expend their spirits to the point of exhaustion and continual pretense, overreaching and anticipating others. Virtue has come to consist of doing something in less time than someone else. Hours in which honesty is permitted have become rare. So in a climate of profit maximization, in order to keep up with the Joneses, people are dishonest with regard to themselves. With growth, as Western culture looks at it, apparently only being possible through efficiency and increased efficiency, it is purchased at the price of the individual participants being dehumanized. And so when Nietzsche refers to people as being mere instruments who are constantly chasing after gain, causing them to expend their spirit to the point of exhaustion, with my 21st century ear, I hear people suffering from burnout because of our protocol professionalism, in which we require people to be more productive while giving progressively less attention to their own physical human needs. This leads me to the fourth point, D. Nietzsche is clearly skeptical in his work, The Antichrist, about the claims of science and technology to be the epitome of professional activity in a market-driven economy, since, as he sees it, the results of profit maximization lead to the alienation between the individual and life, the individual and the work he does, and the individual and the product he produces. So he says, handicraft, trade, agriculture, science, the greatest part of art, the whole quintessence of professional activity, to sum it up, is compatible only with a mediocre amount of ability and ambition. To be a public utility, a wheel, a function, for that one must be destined by nature. For the mediocre, to be mediocre is their happiness, mastery of one thing, specialization, a natural instinct. So not only does increasing efficiency demand tighter specialization, but the individual is moved further away from the product and from the consumer as well. By unrelenting efficiency, as you can see, when he talks about a wheel to be a public utility, then you get the sense of the division between the individual and life as well. The consumer only sees the product, and such alienation causes frustration. For what's the significance of an individual who produces yet one more sweatshirt? It just doesn't cut mustard. The fifth point, E, is Nietzsche shows us that in the industrialized world, with a tightened tempo in the workplace, not only is expediency of paramount importance, but human pleasure and delight in what you're doing is somehow all of a sudden irrelevant. In The Antichrist, Nietzsche describes that nothing could destroy us more quickly than working and thinking and feeling without any inner necessity, without any deeply personal choice, without pleasure. Nietzsche makes it evident, and again I admire him for it, that without pleasure in your work, and without the deeply human need for personal choice, human dignity is little more than a fantasy. And so when Nietzsche talks about people being in constantly changing conditions, and being denied the possibility of expressing creativity and personal choice in their professional activity, I recognize the over-specialization of tasks and the consequences thereof in our society driven by professionalism. And the sixth point F, for a society to absolutize the values of expediency and utilitarianism, Nietzsche notices that a degrading generalization has to take place. And beyond good and evil, he says, because they, which is again referring to the herd, address themselves to all, because they generalize where generalization is not authorized. All of them speak unconditionally, and taking themselves unconditionally. It's expediency, 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 mixed with stupidity, stupidity, stupidity. Speaks pretty much for itself. Along with people's blind adherence to what society finds valuable, arises the generalization which Nietzsche refers to stupidity, or otherwise as the herd morality. Nietzsche warns us in The Gay Science that with technology as the driving force behind all of life, contrary to what people may think, the human horizon actually becomes limited. He says, one tries to condition an individual by various attractions and advantages to adopt a way of thinking and behaving that will dominate him to his own ultimate disadvantage, but for the general good. So in his analysis, Nietzsche concludes in Beyond Good and Evil that throughout history there have always been human herds and always a greater number who obey in proportion to a smaller number who command, with the herd morality which is advocated in a market-driven society. However, he notices that people in such a society with their human herds are actually hypocrites. They claim that they have love for their neighbor by obeying the commands of society, while they're actually just forming a cog in a machine. And so Nietzsche asks us in his work, Das Boot Zarathustra, and I'm now down here, who, after all, is your neighbor? And even if you act for the neighbor, you still do not create for him. And learn this for you, creators. Your work, your will, that is your also your neighbor. Do not let yourselves be gulled with false values. In Nietzsche's description of the conditioning of individuals to adopt a general way of thinking and behaving, I hear bells of 21st century bureaucracy ringing, with the controlling requirements of pen pushing and endless reports to give accounts for your actions. But let's now move on to the third part of the lecture. Although I can appreciate Nietzsche's critique of the 19th century society, that it does not work to try to regulate precisely how we should love our neighbor or how we should treat our fellow human being, even in the business world, especially when our motives are actually being guided by economic reasoning, I think that we still need to look closer at Nietzsche's solution to the problem of the human position. And here I'd like to make 5 points. First one is, our solution, according to Nietzsche, lies in the fact that nothing is more real to us than in our own intuitions and feelings and desires of the self. And so Nietzsche launches us into our own inward reality. He concludes in his work Twilight of the Idols that no one gives man his qualities, neither God, nor society, nor his parents and ancestors, nor he himself. No one is responsible for man's being there at all, for his being such and such, or for his being in these circumstances or in this environment. Man is not the effect of some special purpose of a will and end. There is nothing which could judge, measure, compare, or sentence our being, for that would mean judging, measuring, comparing, or sentencing the whole. But there is nothing besides the whole, that nobody is held responsible any longer. We deny God. We deny the responsibility in God. What's Nietzsche implying here? Yeah, this is his idea of... It's the way it is. But it is the way he sees it, obviously, because he's written it. But it's, according to him, the way it is. He would say it's more than his interpretation. He would say this is the fact of what it is.
I think what you're asking is if you see cross-dating this as what ought to be held on to, or if you're looking around to the people who are affected by your question.
Yeah.
And what they see cross-dating, he's saying.
Yeah, although Nietzsche would never say his philosophy is a solution. Yeah. He says this is the way it is.
This is what we must recognize.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So So what the force of what he is implying here is, I'm left alone in this world, and I'm in constant process of becoming, determining and constructing myself. That there's no reality that I can know, nor any environmental framework or technocratic society in which I can find myself. And that the only sense of responsibility to be felt is for myself, for my own desires and passions. And so it's not surprising when Nietzsche says in Beyond Good and Evil, supposing that nothing else is given as real but our world of desires and passions, that we cannot sink or rise to any other reality but just that of our impulses. Subsequently, the existence of a reality outside of himself becomes obscure for Nietzsche. Personal intuition turns out to be a more accurate marker for reality, in which one is free to do or say or think or be whatever one wants to be. But in trying to envisage what Nietzsche means by all of this, I wonder, can we really be human in a universe without a common structure? Is it possible to be satisfied simply with only one's personal pleasures and desires? Secondly, in line with this thinking, Nietzsche claims through the mouth of Zarathustra, his mouthpiece, that God is a conjecture, but I desire that your conjectures should be limited by what is thinkable. Could you think a God? And so Nietzsche is almost implying that God is a fable. He also somewhere in one of his works says that as well. And so instead of turning to God, Nietzsche feels that we should turn to ourselves, to human beings on earth. And he says through Zarathustra, I teach you the Overman, which is a translation of Übermensch, also sometimes translated as Superman. Man is something that shall be overcome. Nietzsche proclaims, therefore, that we're to love ourselves, to overcome ourselves, to become ourselves, we're to restore and refurbish ourselves. And in this, he advocates a selfishness. He'd even go so far as to let Zarathustra teach that selfishness is blessed. He teaches that one must learn to love oneself. And then the third point is he enhances the autonomous self to unlimited heights. And trying to start from the autonomy of human beings, Nietzsche describes the world in which God is dead, the most well-known phrase ever said of Nietzsche. He describes a world in which God is dead and in which the kingdom of God, without God, is replaced by a new kingdom, one in which the autonomous self ascends the throne from which God was dislodged. He says, behind our thoughts and feelings, my brother, there stands a mighty ruler and an unknown sage, the self. However, if we build all of life's meanings on ourselves, are we ourselves, on our own, enough motivation to continue to glorify this kingdom? And the fourth point, Nietzsche even expresses the consequences of his thought with regard to his fellow human being in the gay science. And he says, thus we become hard against everything in us that desires consideration. And our greatness is also our lack of compassion. Quite harsh words. This line of thought, however, brings questions to my mind. Is it possible to live in this world without any feelings for anybody else and without being accountable to someone? Can I exist without any compassion for those around me or from them? Why is it that I have a gut feeling in me that desires consideration? Could it not be that I've been created in the image of the one who created me, who longs for a relationship with me, and who hopes that I would also have a relationship with those around me and have compassion for them? Is that not perhaps part of who I was made to be, someone who would desire a relationship? So fifthly, as God fades out of the picture, true morality sinks away for Nietzsche as well, and the immanence of the self, or the presence of the self, looms large. The enthronement of the self, we could call in today's terms something like the calling card that Nietzsche leaves all over, lets it permeate throughout all of life. But the absence of a moral focus changes everything. Having the moral focus, our moral principles, be replaced by our self-interest has a tremendous effect. It changes the meaning of life, since that which had given meaning to life has apparently evaporated. And along with this breakdown of meaning, a dangerous moral vacuum arises. And it's this moral vacuum which nourishes Nietzsche's ideas of the self. So Nietzsche's view of the self is centered around autonomy and self-expression, with the hope of the self being modeled according to its own desires, to create its own morality in such a way that it can seek its own gain. Nietzsche believes in the dignity and the worth of the individual so completely that the individual is more important than the surrounding community. However, absolutely anything that violates our right to think exclusively for ourselves, judge for ourselves, make our own decisions, live our own lives as we see fit, Nietzsche feels is morally wrong. And here you see slight contradiction. I'm going to make 8 points here under this section to reveal Nietzsche's view. A, in looking at Nietzsche's view of the self, what ultimately stands central is that the self is a law unto itself, as we see in the Antichrist. For Nietzsche, a great person has his own internal ethic. I quote, "A virtue must be our own virtue, our own invention, our most necessary self-expression and self-defense. Any other kind of virtue is merely a danger. A people perishes when it confuses its duty with duty in general. Nothing ruins us more profoundly, more intimately, than every impersonal duty." And this leads me to the second point, B. When moral virtues come to stand alone, when they are disengaged from those around us and are privatized, the virtues, plural, become compressed into virtues, singular. And C. Morality becomes so relativized for Nietzsche that virtues actually cease to be virtues. Instead, he tends to refer to them as values, which are determined by the self. And these values are based on personal desires and preferences and passions. This shift is detectable in Beyond Good and Evil when Nietzsche writes, "He knows that it is he himself only who confers honor on things. He's a creator of values. He honors whatever he recognizes in himself. Such morality equals self-glorification." For Nietzsche, this transition is a deliberate outcome of his belief in the death of all transcending truth and the death of God and morality. And so having lost his moral bearings and forfeited his moral imagination, his capacity to think of himself as a moral being, Nietzsche embarks on a comprehensive search of a new moral understanding of the self. And this leads me to the fifth point, E. While rapidly losing any existing moral altitude, moral plateau, Nietzsche also denies that there's any moral purpose for which the self can strive. You erase all purpose for human existence. This has large consequences for the view of yourself. And so if, along with this eradication, evolves a separation of value from fact. Leslie Newbegin, in his book Proper Confidence, reminds us that without a purpose to exist, there's no way to think any evaluation either, or to make any evaluation. In Twilight of the Idols, it appears as if even Nietzsche is aware of this distinction in the way in which he reveals his view of the self. He says, "To see what is, that's the mark of another kind of spirit, the anti-artistic, the factual. One must know who one is." So do you get the difference between a separation of value from fact here? Because what the fact would be is to see what is, to know who one is. And any external moral authority could not bring any value upon the fact of who you are. For Nietzsche, there's apparently no distinction between an external authority which can assess whether your actions are morally good or bad. It's only the fact of who you are. And so, in the next point, G, what Nietzsche is actually just advocating is a morality based on egoism. Any other type of altruistic morality, he finds, is hypocritical. As he says in Twilight of the Idols, an altruistic morality, a morality in which self-interest wilts away, remains a bad sign under all circumstances. The best is lacking when self-interest begins to be lacking. Personal rights seem to reign supreme here. H, as we isolate ourselves, evil becomes ordinary, for there's no one outside of ourselves with whom its atrocity can be measured. David Wells, in his book Losing Our Virtue, reminds us that if the world outside of us diminishes with God's sovereign order, his moral norms and social obligations receding, the world inside us magnifies to account for the loss. Nothing is more real to us then than the intuitions, feelings, and desires of the self, whether they're evil or not. And so when a person's moral understanding of life, of his or her place in the cosmos, becomes private and individualized, a rampant relativism is loosed on society. One last phrase, which is well known to Nietzsche, that I'll lightly discuss here, is the will to power. In order to have the will to power, to say yes to life, according to Nietzsche, we need to reveal the evil in us. The will to power, to create yourself, to reassemble and refurbish yourself, is to have the will to live without moral codes superimposed upon you. And this is Nietzsche's reality. In conclusion then, in looking at all of this, we need to ask, will the relentless pursuit of desires in a world without real moral norms not lead us into a horrific chaos and a suffocating anxiety? In following Nietzsche's new egoistic moral license, stripped of any moral compass, will the actual outcome not be groping blindly in the darkness of nihilism, in the darkness of nothingness? What I think needs to be determined in this regard is whether it is worse to fall short of moral ideas or moral ideals than to have none to fall short of. In order to evaluate Nietzsche's solution in light of our professionalism dilemma, we need to ask, is there any difference between Nietzsche's remedies and those of our society at large, strewn with consumer beings who believe that they are what they have, that what they find missing with regard to themselves can be recovered by the way they refurbish themselves? A flexible self who can refurbish itself and reinvent its own values seems to me to be the logical counterpart to a consumption-driven economy with its required endless adaptation. Is Nietzsche's chameleon an answer to our times? Has Nietzsche actually provided a viable solution for us? In Nietzsche's analysis, we see that he did diagnose a very relevant problem. For many Christians have unfortunately made a caricature of compassion, hypocritically allowing their egoism to take precedence. But this is all the more an illustration of the fact that humanity without love and compassion leads to a society which only worships power, technology, and utility, or technological control and utility. If in reaction we, as Nietzsche tries, then attempt to remain solely involved with our temporary existence, will we ever truly find ourselves in our professionalism dilemma? Our relationship with God, as I see it, not only helps us to orient ourselves, but it also reveals to us to whom we are responsible in the things we do and in the challenges we accept in our horizontal relationships. But there may not be precise regulations as to how we are to love our neighbor. But in Scripture, we're definitely given some guidelines for loving our neighbor, as well as our Creator. And this is part of the adventure of life, to be able to be creative in the way in which we apply those guidelines of loving each other. And getting back to our earlier discussion of a market-driven society and professionalism, how can we put this into practice? I think that to humanize any profession, any task, anyone's existence, in fact, is to work actively into that job, to raise questions, and to allow the job and all its professionalism to address me with questions, to allow the job to answer the question, why do you do this? To allow the job to show you that it really matters that you tighten the bolts or arrive clean on the job or connect and relate as human beings to your neighbor at tea time, entering into conversation with yourself and with each other, obviously respecting the principal differences between client and professional and employee and employer and professional and scientist, etc. To humanize a profession, I need to ask myself what my responsibilities are with regard to my fellow human being, with regard to his needs and qualities. I need to counteract the stressful existence of the professional world with being personally involved with expressing my unique personality and character in the hard work I do as I'm led and called by God. And not to allow the work to swallow me up, but instead to be an expression of my creative abilities. And ultimately not to allow my work to be measured primarily in numbers, but in heart change. To retain my human dignity, I need to understand that there is a world out there that I need to work into. It means that I'm a unique creature made in the image of God, and that I must seek to express this in my compassionate action. So those are my ideas of why I appreciate what Nietzsche has to say, but where I find his reaction to the problem of it wanting. Do you have any ideas or thoughts in which I can learn something more? Or questions? Yeah. Yeah. Well, he went insane, I think, partly also because he had syphilis. But it could also be because he contradicted himself so thoroughly and had to try and live it out and couldn't. I do think that that might also have something to do with it. But for him, a loss of human dignity is the problem. And so he thinks, I need to solve it myself and forget the rest because I can't be sincere in my reactions towards others. And so because I can't make a sincere choice towards them that can only actually have selfish desires in my choices for others, I should just center on myself. And so he doesn't see it as contradiction, saying, have no compassion for your fellow human being. That's ridiculous, because I can't do it sincerely, because I'll always have an ulterior motive. I'll always have another reason for doing what I do. I'll only help you because you might help me tomorrow, or that type of motivation. Although he would say they claim that they are not. They are looking for their self-interest, but they're claiming that they're doing it for the good of the people around them. And that's where he just gets... What did you want to say? Yeah.
Yeah. This is very slim spot of his stuff. And there's a lot more there. So we shouldn't just judge by this stuff. This is just a small paper.
No, I'm not judging that. I mean, it's just trying to be curious.
The idea of wanting to... Yeah, he doesn't, he'd go further though, he wouldn't say reevaluate, he'd just say, you know, the hypocrisy's gotten the end of me, you know, don't go any further, just get rid of it all.
Well, that's
yeah, I think though it's a good reminder for us to try and live out the gospel in a way in which we can really be sincere in what we say, so that other people don't look at us and think, well, actually, those are just fully your personal selfish motivations that are driving your actions. Yeah, that's the point I was making. Yeah. But they definitely can also... I see a link between what he was saying and the fact that we still have traces of his critique in our professionalism society today, of people having burnout and not being able to express themselves creatively in what they're doing. Losing themselves, therefore.
was interested in projecting that one. Is that something that you need to do with that personal narrative to survive your better art?
Well, I use the word solution a bit scarefully, afraid, because he doesn't give the word solution himself. And so he doesn't want to pose great arguments as solutions. But he definitely, he looks at the herd morality, where people are all just following what society requires of them. As only running on fulfilling these moral obligations that society imposes on them, because they think God asks that of them. And he says, you're following them because of your personal desires, not because of what God is wanting of you. And so you're just creating this human conjecture of God. But does that answer your question? I think it's fully. Also, the idea of instincts is something that he wants to rely on heavily. You're going to ask something? Yeah, and in that sense, I would almost agree with his idea that God is a conjecture for those people, or just something they don't really believe in his existence. That it would change their lives or have implication in their lives. But it's a constant struggle to live it out in a way in which is glorifying to God. Something that we constantly need to ask for strength for from God to be able to do something we can't do in our own strength. What do you think?
Like John Fyfe, you go on the dog and it goes along that vein.
Yeah, I think that it, by fallen human nature, we are selfish. But I continue the next lecture by asking, can we find ourselves if we have no compassion for our fellow human being? And so if we'd only go by the route that you're describing of just selfishly thinking only about ourselves and not thinking about anybody else, I don't think we would in the end find out who we are or be able to even be fully who we are. So, definitely, because on our own strength we can't manage, and in our own strength we end up trying to be selfish or end up being selfish, not succeed in thinking about it. Yeah. Since we were going to need to have dinner prompt on time so that people can go and watch Much Ado About Nothing, let's close here. Thank you for your participation. Good.
Thank you.